Welcome to this session on superior human relations. In many respects, this is the most important session of the entire psychology of achievement. We've been talking about superior human relations from the very beginning because superior human relations arise from our being fully together and fully in harmony with the laws of our being in every area of our life. As a matter of fact, every single part of our personality, every single part of our adjustment, every single part of our self-image, our self-esteem, is tied up and is expressed always in the quality of the relationships that we have with other people. We call this session superior human relations because we feel that the most important single thing that an individual can develop in their life is the ability to enjoy superior human relations with other people. We know that in our studies in humanistic psychology, in interviewing people, we find that 85% of all the joy and satisfaction that we ever achieve as human beings comes from our interactions with other people, happy interactions with other human beings. That only 15% can be attributed to all other sources and can be, if you like, subsumed under the title of earned success. In other words, we get 15% of our joy and satisfaction from achievement and success in life, but 85% of all the pleasure that we'll ever enjoy as human beings is going to come from our ability to get along with others. So therefore, if we can increase our ability to get along with others, if we can develop superior human relations, we can get far more joy and satisfaction out of life. I'd like to introduce you to a final law. We've talked about some of the other mental laws that govern our existence. And in the study of superior human relations, one of the more important laws is what we call the law of indirect effort. The law of indirect effort says that in our activities with other people, we get almost everything that we want and that we desire in an indirect way rather than in a direct way. For instance, if we want to get happiness, everybody wants to be happy. Everybody wants to be happier than they are. And yet Aristotle, in his work in Nicomachean Ethics over 2,000 years ago, pointed out that happiness is not a destination, but that happiness is a process or a condition, and that a person is only happy when they are engaging in activities that give them a sense of personal growth and fulfillment. So we never achieve happiness by going out and trying to become happy directly. We only achieve our happiness by engaging in activities on a day-to-day basis which we find valuable and worthwhile. And the unhappiest people in our society are people who are doing things that they find lacking in meaning, lacking in purpose, lacking in relevance, and they're striving to be happy at the same time. And it's simply not the way it works. With regard to our interpersonal relationships, for instance, if we want to impress other people, the hardest way to impress other people is by trying to impress other people. We've all made the mistake of trying directly to impress others with the type of person that we are. And yet we find by using the law of indirect effort or the law of indirect activity that the finest way to impress another person is to be impressed by them. The more impressed we are by another person's qualities and abilities, the more impressed they are with our qualities and abilities, and especially our abilities to discern. If we want other people to be interested in us, the surest way to get other people to be interested in us is to be interested in them. If we want people to believe in us, the surest way to get people to believe in us is to believe and to trust and to have faith and confidence in them. If we want people to like us, the best way is to like them. If we want to have a friend, as Emerson said, we must first be a friend. If we concentrate all of our efforts on being a friend and on liking and on trusting other people, then we find that we have no difficulty at all getting people to be our friends and to like and to entrust and to enjoy us. If we want other people to respect us, the surest way to achieve that is to respect other people. But there are other reasons why it is important that we increase our ability to get along well with others. And in terms of healthy personality, which we all want to have and which we all want to have even more of, we all want to have the healthiest personality possible, there are two definitions of healthy personality which I think are very important. One, again, comes from Emerson, where he says that an individual has a healthy personality to the exact degree to which they have the propensity to look for the good in every situation. I think that's a very neat definition. The tendency to look for the good in every situation is a direct measure of how healthy your personality is. And all you have to do is refer to your own experience and to the people that you know, and you'll find that the unhealthiest, unhappiest people that you meet are people who look for the bad in every situation. The healthiest and the most positive and the most fulfilled people are people who continually look for the good in each situation. There's another definition that comes from recent work in psychology, which is even more important and more relevant to this subject, and it is that an individual has a healthy personality to the exact degree to which they can get along with the greatest number of other different types of people. In other words, the individual who can get along with the greatest variety of people, people from the most introverted to the most extroverted, is the one who has the healthiest personality of all. That the individual who can get along only with a few people and only with people who have very bland or average personalities is the individual who has the unhealthiest personality. And if we go to our mental institutions, we find that the people who have to be hospitalized in our mental institutions, the ones who have the unhealthiest personalities of all, are unable to get along with anyone. Now, if we take this scale of healthy personality, this ability to get along with a wide range of others, and we superimpose another scale on it, we find that our ability to get along with other people is in direct relationship to the height of our self-esteem. As we talked about in the first session in this program, how much we like ourselves is the direct measure of how much liking we have for other people. That how much we like ourselves is the exact measure and the key critical determinant of the quality of our human relations. And every single thing that we do to raise our own self-esteem and to like ourselves even more and to value ourselves and to see ourselves as worthwhile and important people causes us to like and to accept other people more and to see them as valuable and worthwhile. A person with very high, genuine levels of self-esteem and self-acceptance has naturally and without effort the ability to get along with the greatest number of other people. A very simple example of this is a person who's in love. A person who is in love and who is genuinely loved by another person feels terrific about themselves. And when they're in love, as the song says, they feel 10 feet high. And when they're in love, they seem to get along with everybody. They see sunshine and flowers everywhere. They are happy. They are charming. They're cheerful. And whenever you see a couple of lovers come into a restaurant or a cafe or a social event, you find that everybody around them smiles. Everybody around them feels good simply because they feel so good about themselves. So the very most important thing that we can do as human beings to increase the quality of our human relations is to learn to like and accept ourselves as valuable and important people. All through this program, we've been talking about how important it is to say things like, I like myself, I like myself, I like myself, and to psychologically build ourselves up rather than tear ourselves down. We've also talked about how important it is to set goals and to make plans and to work toward them, because every time we set a goal and begin moving step by step toward it, we feel terrific about ourselves. We feel more and more like winners. We feel more and more like valuable people. So you find that the happiest, most positive, most enthusiastic people in our society are also the most intensely goal-oriented. The more goals they have, the more committed they are to achieving them, the more progress that they're making on a step-by-step, day-by-day basis, the happier they are and the better they get along with everybody that they meet. It is people who are going nowhere, who are negative and down on themselves, who have the worst of all human relations. That brings us to our question, what can we do on an ongoing day-to-day basis to improve the quality of our relationships with others? Aside from working on ourselves, what can we do to and with and for other people to improve the quality of our interactions with them? Fortunately, we all know the answer by this time. We all know that everybody that we meet has a self-concept and a level of self-esteem that is lower than it needs to be. Everybody we meet has a burning need for more self-esteem, for a higher feeling or a higher sense of self-liking and self-worth, that you'll never meet anybody, including the great and the powerful, the people in high positions in corporations and politics, you'll find that even they have needs for a high level and for reinforced levels of self-esteem. So if this is the case, and since we're also the same, since we also need our own self-esteem boosted on a regular basis, everything that we do as we go through life to raise the self-esteem of others will increase the quality of our human relations. And since we know what other people do that raises our self-esteem, if we simply do the same things to and for other people, the law of indirect action, that other people do to and for us that cause us to feel good about ourselves, then that is the key that will unlock the finest human relations that we can have. And there's one additional point as we begin to talk about these things that we can do, and that is this. We are constructed as human beings as the greatest miracle of all of nature. And one of the great miracles is that we cannot do anything to raise the self-esteem of another person without simultaneously raising our own to the same degree. Every single kind and warm and heartfelt and sincere and generous thing we do to make another person feel good about themselves causes us to feel good about ourselves. We're constructed in such a way that this law of reciprocal or a law of indirect action works 100% of the time, and that if we go through life doing everything possible to build other people and make other people feel good and valuable about themselves, then we automatically cause ourselves to feel good and valuable about ourselves. Think what a terrible world it would be if it was possible to do it the other way around. Think what a terrible world it would be if it was possible to tear down other people and build ourselves up simultaneously. That's why you find that individuals who engage in destructive interactions with others, who tear other people down and make them feel bad, also tear themselves down simultaneously and become very negative and destructive personalities. Individuals who go through life consciously and deliberately and purposefully trying to make other people feel good about themselves also build themselves, and they feel great about themselves, which gives them more self-confidence and self-assurance to build others, which causes them to build themselves even more until they become the most successful, the most beloved, the most valuable members of their generation. What are some of the things that we can do then? Or what are some of the things that other people do for us that make us feel terrific? I think you could really summarize it in one expression, and that is simply to make others feel important. And if you like to extend it, not ever to do anything to others that causes them to feel unimportant. If you can go through life consciously trying to make other people feel important, then that alone is enough to assure that you will have the most superior of all human relations. And some of the things that we can do to make other people feel important that have come out of the work in interpersonal psychology, first of all, is acceptance. Acceptance is one of the deepest subconscious cravings of human nature. Acceptance means that we accept another person totally and unconditionally for who they are, warts and all, as Shakespeare said, just simply accept them without judgment, without condemnation, for who they are, for what they think, for the way they dress, and especially if they're different from us. It's very easy to accept people who are just like us and who do and say things that are completely consistent with what we consider to be the norms of society. But the people that we need to accept are people who are different from us. We especially need to accept teenagers. We especially need to accept young people who have different ideas. We especially need to accept people who are different from us ethnically or racially or in their social orientation or in their socioeconomic categories. And the way that we express acceptance, the clearest, the simplest way to express acceptance of another human being is simply to smile. Smiling conveys 1,000 words in one simple gesture. To smile at another person simply says to that other person that I consider you to be worthwhile and valuable, and I accept you on your own terms. And we know that whenever two human beings meet, the very first thing that takes place, the very first interaction, even before any words are exchanged, is the either acceptance or non-acceptance of one by the other. And until that acceptance or non-acceptance is established, no further communication is really possible. So whenever we meet another person, remember that the first thing that the other person is looking for and the first thing that we are looking for is acceptance or confirmation of ourselves as valuable and worthwhile people or persons in their eyes. The second thing that we can do to make other people feel important is approval. Approval is one of the strongest ways of building self-esteem in other people. As a matter of fact, one of the definitions of self-esteem is the degree to which an individual feels praiseworthy, or the degree to which an individual feels worthy of approval of others. And when we give other people our approval, when we praise and approve and reinforce everything that a person does that is right or that is good, every single time we do that, their self-esteem goes up and they feel better about themselves. Now, when we give praise, we also know that, especially in corporations, and some of the things that we're talking about here are the keys to building super employees and dynamic corporate environments. When we give praise, praise must be specific. It's not sufficient to say, you are a great person, or you're a great secretary, or you're a fantastic salesman. This kind of praise is usually discarded as being largely worthless and insincere. When we praise other people, we must always praise a specific act or actions. In other words, if we praise a secretary, we say, "That was a beautiful letter that you typed for me." When we praise a salesperson, you say, "That was an excellent sale that you closed," or "That was a terrific way to achieve your quota." Always praise the specific act or actions that you want to see repeated. Always praise and reinforce the sort of things that you want to see done over and over again. Another thing that we know about praise is that praise should not be continuous, but should be intermittent. We should praise at intervals rather than praising every single thing that a person does. We should praise on a regular basis, but intermittently and unpredictably. And also, finally, we should praise immediately. The more immediate that praise follows an action that we consider to be commendable, the more likely it is that the person will repeat the action. We also know another interesting thing about praise is that if we wish people to behave in a certain way and to perform certain actions, then what we do is we praise them each time and intermittently each time they do something that we consider praiseworthy, and we simply ignore the other actions. And we find that over time, people will do more and more of the things for which they get praise and approval, and they will do less and less of the things for which they get no response at all. And over time, their behavior will be permanently modified, and this is a powerful technique to use with children and with husbands and wives. Another thing that we can do to make other people feel important is appreciation. Appreciation, or expressing gratitude, is one of the most important single things that we can do to raise the self-esteem of others. And how do we do that? Very simply by saying thank you. I have traveled all over the world, and I have found that you can get halfway across any country in the world by saying please and thank you. And learning those words, I always stop at the border, and I learn how to say please and thank you, and I learn how to count and get a few numbers and to say how much, and that's too much. But the words please and thank you will get you across any country in the world. I found that when you go to other countries, if you treat people like you are guests in their home and treat them courteously and politely, you'll never have any problems at all. I remember some years ago when I was living in the Far East, a friend of mine from Italy wrote to me and said that he wanted to travel throughout Asia. And he wondered if I could give him any advice. And of course, he wanted to go to about half a dozen different countries. And so I said, look, I can't give you advice on half a dozen countries, but I'll give you one piece of advice. And if you'll follow it, you'll never have any difficulties at all. And that is to be excruciatingly patient and polite with everybody that you meet while you're traveling. If you treat each person like you're a guest in their country, and you treat them with respect, even though they are poorer than you are, even though they have fewer advantages, even though they're not as well educated, if you'll do that, you'll never have any difficulties at all. About 2 months later, he wrote back to me from Italy. He had traveled throughout Asia, gone back to Italy. He said that was the most valuable advice he'd ever received in his life. He traveled with other people who did not practice that advice, and they had nothing but problems. He said people stood them up, people overcharged them, people cheated them. He said people would not give them hotel rooms. He said he never had a single problem. He traveled all over Asia, never had a problem with it. And it's very good advice. Appreciation causes another person to feel valuable, to feel that what they're doing and they're saying is of value and of consequence to others, and it makes them feel worthwhile. Another thing that we can do is admiration. Admiration is a tremendous way of building the self-esteem of another person. And the things that we admire are always traits, for instance, like punctuality or industriousness or generosity, or possessions, things that people own. I think if you go to visit a person in their office or you go to visit a person in their home, one of the smartest things and the kindest things that you can do is to pick something that is obviously attractive, that is obviously important within the environment, and just say, that is a beautiful picture, or that is a lovely table, or that's a beautiful vase. Because people decorate their offices, and especially their homes, with things that are important to them, with possessions that are important to them. A very good suggestion which we give to both men and women, but women especially, is to take special care with the way men dress. Men are really funny about the way they dress, and they are very fastidious about two things. They're fastidious about their ties, and they're fastidious about their shoes. And they take a lot of care in thinking about their ties and shoes. Men usually only have a few pairs of shoes, sometimes only one or two pairs, whereas women have a lot of different pairs of shoes. Men are very conscious of both ties and shoes. And if a woman ever wants to disarm a man, a simple way to do it is to just say, by the way, that's a beautiful tie you're wearing. You will find that if you do that in the middle of a conversation, the person will just go right off the record. They will forget completely what they were saying. They'll look at the tie, they'll be completely taken aback. And of course, if our aim is to develop high levels of self-esteem in others, to make other people feel valuable about themselves, it's absolutely essential that we never, never, never criticize. There is nothing that more destroys human personalities, that undermines self-esteem and lowers self-confidence and causes negative, if not hostile and violent reactions, than the use of destructive criticism on other people. Sometimes you can make a dramatic improvement in your life if you'll just make one single rule, and that is to refuse to criticize anybody for anything. We know, by the way, that nobody ever does anything that they think is wrong. Everybody only does things that they think are right based on the information that they have. That man is, if you like, a rationalizing animal and is capable of rationalizing almost any action, and that it is psychologically impossible for a human being to do something that they consciously know to be wrong. That it is not possible for us to do anything until we have worked out in our mind a rationalization that allows it to be right for us to do whatever it happens to be. In the study of the most violent criminals who have perpetrated the longest crime sprees, when you talk to them and interview them, they found over and over again that these people can explain and rationalize away every single thing they ever did as somehow having been right and acceptable under the circumstances that they faced. So never, never, never criticize, because first of all, it doesn't do any good. A person who is criticized simply becomes angry and antagonistic. Second of all, it tears down people's self-esteem. And third of all, every time you criticize someone else, you tear yourself down simultaneously. Eliminate destructive criticism from your interaction patterns with other people. And also, in the same vein, try to never, never argue with other people. As the poet says, a man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. And when we argue with another person, what we're doing is we're saying to them, in effect, that your thoughts, your opinions, your ideas, your values, everything that you have learned in your lifetime is nonsense, that you are wrong. And people hate to be told that they are wrong. People hate to be suggested that they are wrong. And instead of arguing with people, I think one of the finest techniques that you can use is, first of all, don't argue at all if you can possibly avoid it. However, if you do get into a conversation where the person is obviously wrong and the stakes are such that you cannot let the situation pass, then create what they call a straw man or a non-existent third party and get the individual to argue against the non-existent third party. For instance, the way to do this, a person makes a statement that is outrageous or completely incorrect or completely inconsistent with what you think to be the right solution. If you tell the person you are wrong, then the person will argue with you and you'll have a clash of egos that even if you can demonstrate that the other individual's information is incorrect, they will still not back off from the point. So what you do is you say, well, Bill, that's a very good idea and that's a very good point. But how would you answer the question that somebody might ask that would be like this? Or I was reading in the newspaper the other day, somebody was saying that the real explanation for that is this. How would you deal with that kind of an argument? Or how would you handle a customer who would suggest that this doesn't satisfy that particular requirement? And you get the individual to start arguing against a person who's not there. If you can present your points objectively enough, and if it becomes clear to the individual that, yes, maybe they hadn't considered certain things, it's much easier for them to back down in an argument against somebody who is not in the room than to back down in an argument against you. But the basic rule with regard to argument, just like the basic rule with regard to criticism, is try to eliminate it from your discussions with others. When I was a young man, I used to criticize all the time. I used to think that I was very, very smart and that I could tear anybody's arguments to pieces. I was like Zorro, if you like, intellectually. I would get into political arguments. I would get into social arguments. I would get into economic arguments. And I would take whatever anybody had to say and I would just slash it to pieces. I noticed a very interesting phenomena began to occur. I began to spend an awful lot of time by myself. And I remember once approaching a group of people at a party. And they were talking about something in politics, and I said, aha, this is my field. I'm going to go in there and straighten them out. As I approached the group, most of whom knew me, I saw all of them look up, look in my direction, and then the group simply evaporated. They took off in five different directions. And I never forgot that. I never forgot that even though I knew my subject down cold and that I could take on anybody in a debate on the subject, that it is not enough to be right, but it is only to be effective and to be acceptable and to be part of a social community. And if you have to sacrifice being right to be a positive social animal, then it's better to sacrifice rightness than to sacrifice your social relationships. Another step that we can take to build other people's self-esteem is what is called attention. How do we get the attention of other people? How do we hold other people's attention? We know a very interesting thing about attention, and that is this, is that we always pay attention to what we value, and we always ignore what we do not value, and that the quality of attention that we have is one of the most important single statements about us as a human being, that the more attention we pay to other people, the more we convey to them in a way that cannot be conveyed any other way, that we consider them to be valuable and important. We as adults have all had the experience of speaking to somebody who is not listening to us or who turns away or who ignores what we say, and we know what happens to us. We become angry at the rudeness, we become offended, we become irritated, and it's exactly the same thing when we are talking to someone else and we are not paying attention to them or when we do not pay proper attention to the people that are important to us. The way that we pay attention primarily is by listening. And as the philosopher has said, God has given man two ears and one mouth, and that's probably the best proportion for him to use them in, or for her to use them in. In other words, we should always listen twice as much as we talk. And in listening to other people, we convey to them in a very powerful way that we consider them to be valuable and important people. In listening, we find three things happen. Intent listening builds trust between the two parties, and there is probably no other way to build trust than to take the time to listen carefully to what another person has to say. We know that the people that we trust and that we respect and that we admire the most in our lives are the people who listen to us the most attentively when we have something to say or when we need to express ourselves. We also know that listening builds character in the listener, because active listening, concentrated listening, takes self-discipline. Our minds function at about 450 to 500 words a minute, whereas the average person speaks at about 100 to 150 words a minute, which means that we have the ability to think about other things for about two-thirds of the time while someone else is talking to us. If we do not consciously concentrate on what they are saying, we will very likely find ourselves thinking about something else and missing the complete point of what they're trying to convey to us. So the more we concentrate on what the other person is saying, the more rapidly it builds our own sense of self-discipline and our own character. And finally, the third thing we know about listening is that listening builds self-esteem in the person listened to. That when a person is listened to carefully and attentively by another person, their self-esteem goes up like a thermometer on a hot day. That the more we listen attentively to another individual, the more valuable and worthwhile they feel about themselves. And of course, the more they like us and the more they value us, because the more we make another person feel good about themselves, the better that they will feel toward us. And many salespeople, for instance, have made a fortune simply by becoming extremely good listeners with their clients and with their prospects. Three or four points on effective listening. Number one is to listen attentively. Face the person squarely, lean forward, and concentrate 100% totally without mental wandering or without distraction or interruption on what the person is saying. Second point is to pause before replying. Pausing before replying is classy in a human interaction. When you pause before replying, you first of all assure that the person is not just stopping to take a breath. And second of all, you convey to the person that you are giving careful consideration to what they're saying. And third of all, we find that when you pause before replying, just waiting 3 to 5 seconds before you interject, you will hear what the person is saying far better than if you immediately start speaking immediately the other person has stopped. Pausing before replying is a very, very important part of effective listening. A third point is to feed it back so that you get what they are saying perfectly clear. In other words, if a person has said a statement to you or has made a point, and you are the slightest bit ambiguous about what they are saying, feed it back and say, so what I understand you're saying is this, or now let me make sure I've got this clear. And then repeat it back to them, and they say, yes, that's exactly what I'm saying, which again conveys to them that you are listening intently and that you value the communication, and only then respond. And there's an expression which I learned many, many years ago, which is not grammatically perfect, but which is one of the most powerful expressions for clarifying a person's meaning that I've ever learned. And it's simply this, how do you mean? Whenever a person says something to you that you're not entirely sure of, say to them, well, how do you mean that exactly? Or how do you mean? And you'll find many people say things that are unclear even to themselves. And if you ask the question, how do you mean, it gives them a chance to rephrase it in such a way that you will get it clear the second time. And in every case where I find myself unsure of what the person actually means, almost invariably I'm wrong and I have not heard them properly. And finally, the fourth key point in effective listening is to ask questions and to ask open-ended questions and to help the person open up and express themselves fully. And the best questions of all in effective listening are what and where and when and who and how and why. As Rudyard Kipling said, I had six honest serving men who taught me all I knew. Their names were what and where and when and which and why and who. You can use these six words over and over again as open-ended questions or as the preface to open-ended questions to elicit and expand on what a person is saying and accept full responsibility for the entire communication. These few comments, these few ideas on raising the self-esteem of others can be extremely valuable if you use them and build them into your life as a habit. And always remember the boomerang. And the boomerang theory simply says this, is that whatever genuine emotion that we express toward any other person boomerangs back on us with redoubled force. In other words, anything that we say directly or indirectly to or about another person is going to come back to us with redoubled force. And the boomerang always starts off in our hand. As Shakespeare once said, the fragrance of the rose lingers on the hand that casts it. So be very sure that what you cast toward other people has a fragrance that you want to linger on your own hand. That's one of the keys to successful human relations. These comments that we've talked about in terms of developing superior human relations are important in our interactions with everyone. The most important place to start with them is in the house, with our children, with our families, with our spouses, with our companies, and with our close social relationships. But I'd like to talk now about the special type of relationships, marriages and relationships, and some of the key problems that arise in marriages and relationships, and some of the things that we can do to alleviate these problems. The first problem that arises in marriages and relationships, and we'll just call them relationships between men and women, is what we call lack of commitment. Lack of commitment arises when one or the other party is not willing to commit themselves wholeheartedly to the relationship. You can tell a relationship that is suffering a lack of commitment because very often it will be a go halfway relationship or a trading relationship where one party says, I'll go halfway if you go halfway. I'll do my share if you do your share. Many relationships that we've seen that are based on a lack of commitment, you'll find that each person is expected to pay exactly 50% of all of the expenses and that they are constantly keeping a very close track, even right down to postage stamps and utility bills and packages of cigarettes. A lack of commitment in a relationship sends a very strong negative signal to the other party or sometimes to both parties. And what it suggests is that you are not good enough for me to make a total commitment to you. And the way that we overcome a lack of commitment is by making an individual decision that we are going to commit ourselves totally to the relationship, no matter what. And this is not a decision that we make in joint discussion. This is not a decision that we negotiate. It's a decision that we decide to make in the silence of our own room, if you like, and say that no matter what, I am committed wholeheartedly and totally, and nothing will cause me to leave this relationship. An interesting thing happens when two people are in a relationship where there's a lack of commitment and one decides to make that commitment unequivocally. One of three things happens. First of all, they'd find that they can't do it because they don't value the relationship enough. The second thing that might happen is that once they've made the commitment, they may find that the other person will not make a total commitment because they don't value the relationship enough. And the third thing that might happen, and usually the most important thing that can happen, is that the other person may have the courage to make a total commitment also. Very often, the reason why people hold back from making a commitment in a relationship is because they're afraid that they're going to get hurt, they're afraid that they are too vulnerable, they're afraid that they will be too exposed if they make the commitment. And if one person has the courage to commit themselves wholeheartedly to the relationship, often it gives the other person the courage. And ending the lack of commitment sometimes takes an enormous amount of tension and stress out of a relationship between two people. By the way, with regard to marriage contracts, which is an indication of a lack of commitment, a friend of mine who is a lawyer who drew up marriage contracts for about 5 years found in going back over his practice that 99% of all the marriages that he ever drew up or organized under a marriage contract collapsed within 3 years. That the idea of a prenuptial contract which lays out the rights and regulations and duties and obligations of each person is an indication that neither one of the two really believe at a deep level that the relationship is going to be successful. Another problem that occurs in marriages and relationships is trying to change the other person or expecting the other person to change. There is nothing that puts more stress into a relationship than the suggestion on an ongoing basis that one person is not quite good enough the way they are and they're going to have to change. Often we find that if we continue to try to get somebody else to change, they dig in their heels, they resist it, they will not change. Even if they want to change, they will not change because of the nagging and the pressure that's put upon them. When we suggest to another person that they need to change, what we are doing is triggering the fear of rejection. We are telling the other person that they are not good enough the way they are for us, and that unless they improve, they're just simply not good. We can alleviate a tremendous amount of stress in relationships by simply accepting the other person totally, for better or for worse, as they are. And you remember Flip Wilson used to come on the stage dressed as Geraldine, and he'd say, "What you sees is what you gets." And in a relationship, what you sees is what you gets. People do not change in relationships unless they sincerely desire to change and unless they are willing to make the efforts. Now, unless a person sincerely desires to make the changes and to make the efforts and to practice the discipline that's necessary, there's nothing that you can do to get them to change. Either accept them the way they are or don't accept them the way they are, but don't try to make them change. All it does is it causes them to become stressed and angry and resentful and to dig in their heels and to fight back. Another problem that occurs in relationships is jealousy. Jealousy is invariably the result of a low self-concept on the person who experiences the jealousy. Jealousy has nothing really to do with the other party at all. The person who is jealous invariably feels that I am not good enough and that therefore nobody could ever really love me as a person. And the way to overcome jealousy is to set goals that are important to you and to work on your self-concept, to say to yourself, I like myself, I like myself, I like myself, and then get busy making your life and your day-to-day activities valuable and worthwhile to you. Because a person with a high positive self-concept and a genuinely high level of self-esteem does not feel jealousy. They know that they are valuable and important and worthwhile in and of themselves, and no matter how anybody else acts or what anybody else says, it does not reflect on their value as a person. This is very, very important. People who suffer jealousy invariably have low self-concepts, and the solution is to get the self-concept up. Another cause of problems in relationships is self-pity, feeling sorry for yourself for something that the other person has or has not done to or for you. We know that self-pity is almost always a learned response. We learn how to practice self-pity from a parent who is very good at practicing self-pity. And when we get into our relationships, we then wallow in self-pity and we're always suggesting that the other person is letting us down. Self-pity is also the result of a low self-concept. And the same formula for dealing with it that we use for jealousy is what applies. Work on your self-concept, get busy on your own goals, accept yourself as a valuable person, and stop feeling sorry for yourself. It's one of the most insincere and worthless of all negative emotions is self-pity. And it's usually based on nothing at all in reality. It's based only on what is going on in our minds. Another problem in relationships is negative expectations. We know by the law of expectations that our expectations, whether positive or negative, of the people close to us always tend to be fulfilled. If we continually accuse the other person of being about to do something that's going to disappoint us, then you can be very sure that if we keep at it, the other person is not going to disappoint our expectations. So the basic rule in relationships is always expect the best from your mate or from your spouse. The kindest and the most generous thing that a husband or wife can do is to always expect the other to be successful, to continually tell the other that they believe in them, that they trust in them, to encourage them to go for their goals, to encourage them to believe in themselves, to encourage them to keep their spirits up when things go wrong. It's the kindest, most generous, and most fruitful thing that a husband and wife or a boyfriend and girlfriend can do for each other, is to be continually expecting the other to do the very best with their lives and their activities, because those expectations are the ones that will be fulfilled rather than the others. The final problem that we see that happens in relationships is what we call incompatibility. Incompatibility occurs over and over and over again in our relationships for a variety of reasons. One of the reasons is that people are different. And sometimes people meet and they think that they have a lot in common, but as they get to know each other more or as time passes, they find that they have less and less in common and more characteristics and attitudes and values that are incompatible with each other. Many people hold on to relationships long after they have gone dead and the two have nothing whatever in common, they have nothing to talk about, they have no shared values or interests. They hold on to the relationships because they're afraid that if they admit that the relationship has not worked out, they will somehow have failed in the relationship. And rather than admit in their own minds that they have failed, they will stay in a relationship that makes them miserable year after year after year. The fact of the matter is, with regard to incompatibility, is that if a relationship doesn't work out, if two people find that they have nothing left in common, it doesn't mean that anybody has failed. It just means that they're incompatible. It just means that they have nothing left in common. We find, by the way, that the most common period of, if you like, discovered incompatibility is in the late 20s and early 30s. People who get married in their early 20s change dramatically over the course of that decade. And in the period from 28 to 32, you have the highest single incidence of divorce in our society. Because as we go from the 20s to the 30s, we begin for the first time to define ourselves in terms of who we are and what we want to do with the rest of our lives. And at that time, we very often look at our spouse or our mate and find that we have nothing in common with this person. The years have changed us both to the point where we have different interests, we have different desires, we have different social relationships, we have different careers, and we find we have nothing in common. The healthiest and the most positive thing that a person can do or that a couple can do when they find themselves no longer compatible, when they find there is not enough love and happiness and excitement to hold them together, is to let it go and to realize that nobody is to blame. It just happens, just like the rain falls from the sky. Many people say, well, what about the children? The cruelest thing that you can do is to raise children in a loveless home. There is nothing that hurts a child's personality more than to grow up in a home where the parents don't love each other. And this has been demonstrated over and over and over again. You do your children no favor by raising them in an environment that is like a hostile camp. And to remember also this, that with regard to incompatibility and to relationships, the purpose of being in a relationship is to be happier and more liberated and more fulfilled in the relationship than you would be outside the relationship. The reason that we enter into a relationship is to enhance and to improve the quality of our lives, not to decrease the quality of our lives. And if we find ourselves in a relationship where we do not feel that we are happier and better off than we would be if we were alone, then it means that something is wrong with the relationship. It could mean that we're incompatible. And if we can't change the relationship and improve it, the very best thing that we can do is to move on and get on with the rest of our lives. Our most important single goal as human beings must be to fulfill our full potential as individuals. That must be our overarching goal, and everything that we do in our lives has to be examined against the background of that organizing principle. Is what I am doing now, is this relationship, is the quality of my work, is this helping me to become everything that I'm capable of becoming? And if it is not, then we owe it to ourselves, simply on the basis of our own integrity, to be true to ourselves and to take a very careful look at our situation and continually be adjusting it so it is harmonious with who we want to be and where we want to go in our lives. Basic principles of relationships. Basic principle number one is that similar self-concepts attract. Individuals will almost invariably be the happiest with people who are just about as happy as they are. And if ever you get involved in a relationship with a person who is less happy than you are, you will find that the natural result is that the unhappy person drags the happy person down. The happy person never brings the unhappy person up. And many of us have made the mistake of thinking that because we feel good about ourselves, we are going to share our happiness with others. What happens is they simply share their misery with us. And this is one of the major difficulties that we have. A second principle or factor in relationships is that liking and respecting another person is more important and more enduring than being in love. That we need to be in love, but it's possible to fall in and out of love with the same person. It's actually possible to hate and to be furiously angry with the person that you're married to or in love with. But it's absolutely essential that we always like and respect the person. And you can tell if you're ideally suited to another person by asking yourself this simple question: is this person my best friend or not? Because ideal couples are couples in which each is the best friend of the other. Each is the closest and dearest friend, and that there is nothing that they would tell anybody in the world that they would not tell their spouse. So that's the best measure of a relationship. And in order for that to exist, you must really genuinely like and respect another person. You can hate the person, but if the respect and the liking goes, the relationship will go. And the third factor in relationship, or third principle, is that opposites attract, but only in temperament. Nature demands a balance in human temperament. Nature demands that the more outgoing person be matched with the less outgoing person, that the more dominant person be matched with the more recessive person, that the more active person be matched with the more passive person. But nature always demands a balance in temperament in relationships. And the ideal relationships are among people whose temperaments are nicely balanced. In every other aspect, nature requires similarities. Similarities in values, similarities in attitudes toward children, toward money, toward wines, toward restaurants, toward family, toward in-laws, toward the type of living standards, cleanliness, hygiene, religion, politics, all of those things. The greater the number of similarities, the more compatible and happy the couple will be. But the temperaments must be balanced. And you can tell whether or not you are temperamentally balanced by measuring the ebb and flow of conversation between two people. Any two people, male and male and female, or female, can measure their temperamental suitability by measuring how well the conversation goes back and forth. In every conversation, there is a certain amount of time which is taken up, about 90%, with talking, and about 10% is taken up with easy silences. And every single person has a certain amount that they need to talk and a certain amount that they need to listen. And when two people are compatible, the amount that an individual needs to talk is matched by the amount that the other individual needs to listen. For instance, if two people need to talk 45% of the time and listen 45% of the time, they will be very compatible. There will be an easy ebb and flow with 10% of easy silences. If, however, you have the situation where both people need to talk 70% of the time and need only to listen 20 or 25% of the time, you will have a clash over airtime. Who is going to talk the most? Who is going to talk the least? Who is going to bite their lip and let the other person get all their talking out? And who is going to sit there quietly when they're eager to talk? And you'll always find that in a relationship like that, the person who cares the most about the relationship is the one who lets the other person talk the most. The other type of incompatible relationship is when both people get all of their talking out in 30% of the time, and there's a great gap of 40% of uncomfortable silences, and they just sit there and they have nothing to say in that period of time. And very often you see couples in restaurants or couples driving along in the car, and they sit there and they don't talk to each other. They have nothing to say to each other. What that means is that they are temperamentally incompatible. They've reached the point where they simply don't have enough in common to fill the entire time. Let's now go on to the very special and very precious and important relationship, that between parents and children. Perhaps the most lasting and enduring relationship that takes place in our lives, and the relationship that has the greatest single impact on our personalities of all things that happen to us. As a matter of fact, somebody said recently that the average adult in our society spends the second 40 or 50 years getting over the first 5. And I think that's very true. We are marked for life by the quality of the interaction that takes place between our parents and ourselves in the formative years. And let's look at the role of parenting. What is the role of parenting. There have been a lot of books written on this subject. There's thousands of books on parenting. And I am convinced that the role of parenting is simply one thing. Based on everything that we've discussed in this program, the role of parenting is simply to nurture high self-esteem. To the degree to which a parent nurtures high self-esteem in their children, that is the degree to which they have been successful as a parent. A child who comes out of their teenage years and enters into the adult world with a high feeling of self-liking and self-worth is set for life on a solid foundation. And if parents accomplish anything else in the world except building in that high feeling of self-esteem, self-liking, self-respect, self-approval, if they accomplish anything else but that, to the degree to which they do not nurture that high self-esteem, that is the degree to which they have been unsuccessful as parents. There is nothing more important in a young person's life than the continuous flow of high-quality love from their parents, which means that it's absolutely essential that we never use destructive criticism on our children. We never, never, never criticize our children destructively. There is nothing more poisonous, nothing more destructive, nothing that more permanently impairs a child's lifelong effectiveness than to be destructively criticized by their parents. And there is nothing that builds children into strong, healthy, self-confident adults more surely and more rapidly than a continuous flow of love and approval from their parents. You as a parent should tell your children that you love them every day. Tell them by word, tell them by deed, and tell them by four special behaviors that Dr. Ross Campbell has written about in his book, How to Really Love Your Child. He says there's four ways that parents tell their children that they truly love them. Number one way is to make your love unconditional. In other words, make it absolutely crystal clear to your children that there is nothing in the whole world that they could ever do or that could ever happen that would cause you to love them less than 100% totally, all the time, 24 hours a day. A gift of unconditional love is the kindest and most precious gift that a parent can give to a child. There is nothing that makes a child feel more secure and more valuable and more important than knowing that their mommy and daddy love them 100% all the time. My little girl, Christina, is 4 years old, and we play a little game to reinforce this point. And sometimes I'll sit down with Christina, I'll say, Christina, how much does your daddy love you? And she'll hold her hands close together. And I'll say, no, how much do I love you? And she'll hold her hands a little bit wider. And I'll say, how much does daddy love you? And she'll hold her hands wider. And finally, I'll say, come on, Christina. And she'll hold her hands as wide as she possibly can. She says, she'll say, you love me this much. And I say, Christina, I said, what about when I shout at you? She said, you still love me this much, with her arms wide outspread. And I said, but Christina, what about when I send you to your bedroom? She said, you still love me. I said, what about when I spank you? She says, Daddy, you still love me even when you spank me. I said, what about when I shout at you and spank you and put you in your bedroom and you cry? She said, Daddy, you still love me this much, with her arms wide outspread. I said, well, how can that be? She says, Daddy, I know that you always love me no matter what. And I keep telling her that and getting her to repeat it back to me because I want to condition her. I want it to be a habit of thinking in her mind that her daddy and her mommy love her absolutely 100% and that no matter what happens, that is completely unshakable. Make your love totally unconditional. It is the phenomena of conditional love, of love withheld, of love deprivation that is the great destroyer of human personalities. And eliminate that possibility from your family life. The second way that we show our children that we truly love them is through physical contact, through hugging them and kissing them and holding them and patting them and touching them and making it clear to them that we consider them valuable. With physical contact, by the way, we find that little boys receive the same amount of physical contact as girls do up to the age of one, but from the age of one to the age of five, the amount of hugging that boys get drops to 20% of the amount of hugging that girls get. And many psychologists are saying this is one of the reasons why boys are so rambunctious and have such a great tendency to get into things and to get into trouble and to throw themselves around is that they get less and less physical attention, less and less hugging. Virginia Satire, the child psychologist and the family therapist, says that children need 4 hugs a day for survival, 8 for good mental health, and 12 for growth. And I don't think that you can give your children too many hugs and too many kisses, and it's one of the finest ways to convey to a child that you truly love them. A third thing that we can do to tell our children that we love them is eye contact. Children have emotional tanks which run dry continuously. They burn up their fuel. And the way that children refill their emotional tanks and feel truly loved is by experiencing direct, loving eye contact from their parents. Now, the great tragedy of our society is that most parents have no difficulty making direct eye contact with their children when they're scolding them, when they're shouting at them, when they're angry with them. But it's very seldom that parents spend any time looking directly and lovingly at their children and expressing their love for that child with their eyes, smiling at them, so that the child feels like he or she is basking in the warm glow of a loving look or a loving glance. And the more we look at our children with love in our eyes, the more we look at them and smile at them and make it clear to them that we consider them valuable and pay close attention to them, the more they grow as human beings. Children, by the way, infants begin responding to direct, loving eye contact at about 6 weeks. And from then on, they respond to it continuously throughout their lives. As adults, by the way, we find that we are very, very sensitive as a result of childhood conditioning to the way people look at us. If people look at us funny, if people look at us negatively, if people look at us and roll their eyes or skew their glances, it causes us to feel very insecure and uneasy and sometimes very angry. Whereas if people look at us and smile and are relaxed and are pleasant and positive, it causes us to feel safe and secure and good about ourselves. The fourth conduct or the fourth behavior that parents can use is focused attention, which is to spend totally uninterrupted, quiet, quality time with each child every day. Just to sit quietly with no diversion, no distraction, no television, no radio with their child. It's been found in recent research by the American PTA Association that the average father spends 2 minutes a week with their infant child in focused, uninterrupted attention, and that the average father spends 7 minutes a week with their teenage child in pure focused attention. One of the reasons why we have so many problems with teenagers in our society today with alcoholism and sexual promiscuity and drug addiction and even suicide is that parents don't spend very much time with their children. Parents are now taking courses to learn how to detect whether or not their children are taking drugs. If they would spend a little bit of time with their children, a little bit more than 7 minutes a week on average, and that's the average, parents wouldn't have any difficulty with that at all. Children need encouragement, praise, reinforcement, kindness, and patience, especially when they are least lovable and especially when they make their parents the most impatient. Children need to be loved when they are the most exasperating. That's when their emotional tanks are absolutely the lowest. And especially in the teenage years, children need to know that their parents are behind them 100%. Children need to know that their parents love them and believe in them and trust in them and know that they're going to do well. Dr. David McClelland of Harvard found in his studies of high-achieving young people that there are two characteristics that take place in the home that determines whether or not the young people will be high achievers early in life. Characteristic number one is that the home environment is very democratic and that the opinions of the children are respected and listened to, and the children are always included in all family discussions of any importance. The second thing they found is that the parents of high-achieving young people invariably had high positive expectations of the children. They believed in their children, and they told them unequivocally that they believed that they would do well, and they trusted in them. They did not have high positive demands. They did not demand that they performed to certain standards. They did not demand that they got certain grades or performed in certain sports activities. They just calmly and positively expected their children to do well. And the positive expectations that we have of our children will almost invariably be manifested. They'll almost invariably be realized in our lives. So expect only the best from your children. Children should be taught to say, "I like myself," from an early age. We started teaching our children at the age of 2 years old to say, "I like myself, I like myself, I like myself." And Christina says, "I love myself, I love myself, I love myself." And if you ever want to see a child's personality transformed, get them to run around saying, "I like myself," or "I love myself," or look in the mirror. Many families who've been through our course, been through this program, now get their children to look in the mirror every morning and say, "I like myself," or "I love myself." And you'll find that children just brighten up like searchlights when they start saying, "I like myself," and "I love myself," and look in the mirror. And the only person who can give children permission to say, "I like myself," and encourage them to say it over and over again is their parents. They will not and cannot say it all by themselves. They have to be encouraged and given permission by their parents. And remember, children with high self-concepts, children with high self-esteem, children who know that their parents love them and believe in them unconditionally, don't have any problems in school. They get good grades. They're always the most popular kids. They're very seldom sick. They're very seldom absent. They don't engage in promiscuity and drugs and alcoholism and smoking. They don't do things to hurt their bodies or to hurt their minds because they like themselves. And the strongest influence a parent can have over their child is to make it clear to that child that they love them and they believe in them continuously and without reservation and without any conditions at all. Children are subjected to tremendous peer pressure, and the only way parents can help children overcome negative peer pressure is by loving them and believing in them, and thereby having a far stronger influence over them than their peers do. The children who know that their parents love them unconditionally have the strength of character to resist peer pressure in destructive directions. Children who are unsure or insecure, who don't know that, do not have the strength, and children who have no self-concept or low levels of self-esteem can be pushed around and influenced in almost any direction. And our job, of course, is to build self-esteem in our children. What can we do if we have made mistakes in raising our children? What can we do if we have used destructive criticism on our children, and now we have our children with small personality problems, with self-doubts and anxieties and insecurities? We found that there's a very powerful thing that parents can do to correct the balance and to get the situation back to neutral, where it should have been in the first place. And that is to go to your children and sit down with your children, gather them around you, and apologize to them for everything destructively critical or harmful that you have ever done or said to them. Tell them that you're sorry and that you apologize. Tell them that you understand that destructive criticism lowers people's self-esteem and self-concept and undermines their effectiveness, and that you're sorry because you would never have deliberately or knowingly done anything to impair their effectiveness as people, because you want them to grow up to be the happiest, most self-confident adults in the whole world. And when you've apologized, remember that the reason for apologizing is for you to accept 100% responsibility for everything guilt-producing that you've ever said or done to your children, and take the burden of guilt off of your children and back onto you. It's only you as the parent who can apologize. It is only you as the parent who can remove those feelings of guilt and those feelings of anger and those feelings of unworthiness that build up on a child as the result of destructive criticism and physical punishment. And only you can take them off. And the way that you take them off is by simply saying, "I'm sorry, and I apologize, and I'll never do it again." I grew up with a father, as many of us have, who never said he was sorry for anything in his whole life. Many years ago, people thought that if a parent apologized to their children or to their child, it was a sign of weakness, that the children would no longer respect the parent if the parent admitted that they had made a mistake. We know now that this is totally untrue. We know now that when parents apologize to their children, not only does it take courage and character on the part of the parent, but it builds courage and character in their children. It causes the children to see that their parents are human beings, not gods, but human beings that make mistakes just like they do. And when you apologize to your children, it removes that whole burden of accumulated guilt that has built up over the years and causes the child to feel free and to feel fantastic, sometimes for the first time in their life. Then tell your children that you are never going to use destructive criticism again. Tell them that you are going to eliminate destructive criticism from family life and make it a game, make it a policy to never allow destructive criticism in your home. Treat destructive criticism like the bubonic plague or like cancer. You do not want it in your house. Even though you will have arguments and you will have disagreements and you'll have fights and you'll have misunderstandings, those will continue, but you do not use, you abolish destructive criticism from home life. And you tell your children that they have permission to remind you if ever you make a mistake or if ever you slip. That if you forget from time to time, you tell your children, "You catch me, and if I say anything destructively critical, you say, 'Daddy, is that destructive criticism? Mommy, are you using destructive criticism?' And the instant that they catch you, you say, 'Yes, it is. I am sorry. I apologize.'" With my little girl, Christina, sometimes because she's been brought up very, very self-confident and totally unafraid, she's kind of uncontrollable. And sometimes we have to give her a spank, and sometimes we have to put her in her bedroom to settle her down. But I'll always go to her afterwards, and I'll pick her up in my arms, and I'll hug her, and I'll say, honey, I love you very much. But I had to give you a spank because you weren't doing what your mummy said or what you were doing was dangerous. But I want you to know that I love you 100%, and I'm sorry I spanked you. Will you forgive me? And she always says, yes, Daddy, I'll forgive you. The instant that she says that, her face lights up like sunshine. She stops crying. She smiles, and she runs off to play again. The child is not concerned so much with getting a spank or being disciplined. The child's predominant concern is, does my mommy and daddy love me? Do they love me? Do they love me? Do they love me? And we must continually tell our children over and over and over again in every single way possible, yes, I love you. I love you. We love you. We always love you. No matter what happens, we love you unconditionally and we love you totally. Finally, to conclude this program, I would like to give you what I consider to be the purpose of life. In everything that we've studied, in everything that we've looked at, in everything that we have found in psychology and metaphysics and religion and philosophy in the 20th century and throughout all the ages of men, I think that the purpose of life is to develop loving relationships. That when we look back over the landscape of our lives from any particular vantage point, we will find that the most valuable and the most precious things that we have ever enjoyed or experienced are caught up in the quality and the quantity of the loving relationships that we have enjoyed. And if at any time of our life we look back and we have accomplished anything else in the world, financially or materially or politically or any other way, and we do not have high-quality loving relationships to fall back on and to remember and to think about and to enjoy, to that degree we have failed as human beings. And the way that we develop loving relationships is by learning to love and accept ourselves unconditionally and totally as valuable human beings. And the whole course of this program has been to encourage you to do the things on an ongoing daily basis that cause you to feel valuable and important. Saying, I like myself, and accepting full responsibility and eliminating negative emotions from your lives and keeping your mind programmed and positive and on the person that you want to be and the goals that you want to accomplish. Visualizing and talking and thinking continuously of the fine things that you can do with your life and of your better personality, setting goals and working toward them, using your time well so that you feel that your days are valuable and important, using your superconscious creativity to move yourself toward feeling more and more like a winner and a successful person. And we learn to become totally loving persons by learning to love ourselves, by learning to become totally loving people. And then as we begin to build up love for ourselves, we practice by giving our love away to others, because we know that love is the one thing that you can never have any more of except by sharing it with other people. Love only grows by sharing. And the more that you give away by the law of indirect effort that we talked about, the more you give away, the more you get back, and the more you have. And the more you give away, the more you get back, until pretty soon your cup runneth over, if you like, and that the happiest people in the world and the people who have made the most significant impression on all of human history have been the great lovers of history, first and foremost among whom was Jesus of Nazareth, but St. Francis of Assisi and Albert Schweitzer and Sister Teresa, the great lovers, the people who have been able to express love over the widest areas of human history are the people who have changed the whole course of our destinies. So we learn to love ourselves, and then we practice by giving our love away. And I'd like to leave you with a little story. I met a beautiful older woman, a grandmother, in Berlin a couple of years ago, and she had a lovely, radiant, loving way about her. And I asked her about her life, and I asked her what her experiences were in growing up, because she had this rare quality of a truly, totally loving human being. And she said that when she grew up, her mother and her father were very loving people, and they taught them to love and to have kindness and compassion and patience for other people. And they taught them to love each other, and they taught them to love people outside of their families. And she said that it had the greatest impression on her whole life, because she then went on from an obscure background to marry one of the richest industrialists in the United States and to live an extremely good life and have several beautiful children who also grew up the same way. And she said when her parents died, the four children, who are now adults, went back to the home to divide up the remaining possessions. And there was only one thing she wanted of the possessions of her parents that were left. And that was a sign that stood over the mantelpiece and had been over the mantelpiece all the years of her growing up. And on the sign, it had this very simple motto. It said, Only one life that soon is past. Only what's done with love will last. And I think that that's one of the most beautiful sentiments that I've ever heard, because it really summarizes everything that we've learned in this course. It summarizes everything that we've learned about reaching our full destiny as human beings. Only one life that soon is past, only what's done with love will last. Ladies and gentlemen, if we could live our lives to that credo, if we could live our lives and practice the golden rule by learning to love ourselves and learning to love others, only then can we go on to the full realization of our human destiny. Thank you very much.